Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 57, Mechanisms of Non-Mendelian Inheritance and Evolution. This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/biotech.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
I'm Mark Peltier, and this is Futures in Biotech. I'll start off by introducing my co-host today, Dr. George Farr. He's Vice President of Biochemistry and Biophysics at Aromics LLC, this small little company here. And he has a tremendous amount of expertise in protein folding. So I thought I would bring him on to co-host, because today's story and today's guests are experts in protein folding, and they have a really, really interesting story. A story so interesting that we picked it as the story of the year for a panel discussion on episode 50 in December. And so we thought it'd be great if they said yes to actually get a firsthand account, because Futures in Biotech is about the firsthand account. It's getting an audience into the lab, to the best labs in the world, and to talk about the most interesting projects. And this is definitely one that we thought was forward thinking and really exciting. It's really easy. You just pick Dr. Susan Lindquist, see what she's published, and there you go. You've got some really interesting stories. So I'll welcome George to the show.
Hello.
And we have Dr. Susan Lindquist here as our one of our main guests here. We're going to be talking about the work that's been done in her lab and was published last May in Cell. I think it was May. And she's a professor of biology at MIT and an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. And she was the first guest on Futures in Biotech back in June 14th, 2006.
So not a dubious distinction.
No, well, I'd like to say, Dr. Lindquist, that you set the bar really high, and that the guests that I had to be absolutely outstanding. And it kind of helped me get those outstanding guests, because they knew you had been on.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. I'm glad I helped.
Yeah, so it really, really was a huge honor to have you on. It's an honor to have you on again.
Thank you.
I'd like to introduce also...
We talked about the HSP90 stuff then? Was that what
we... Yeah, modulator for the for evolution. It was a really fun story. And
the capacitor.
Yeah, the capacitor. We also have a professor, a group leader from Max Planck Institute of Molecular Cell Biology and Genetics in Dresden, Germany, who was a postdoc of yours who worked on this project. His name is Dr. Simon Alberti. Welcome, Simon.
Hello. Hi.
And we also have Randall Hoffman, sorry. And he was a graduate student. He is a graduate student in Dr. Lindquist's lab at MIT. Welcome, Randall.
It's good to be here, Mark.
So let's get started on the project. We picked the story, and rather than us trying to summarize it, perhaps, Dr. Lindquist, you could tell us a little bit about what the project goals were and so how you got the idea as well to move forward with this, because it's a pretty wild project.
Sure. Well, we had started studying something called a yeast prion really many years ago now. As you introduced earlier, I've been studying protein folding for a good portion of my life here, and it sounds like a rather esoteric subject that not too many people would be interested in, but it turns out that the ways protein fold actually have ramifications in every possible conceivable aspects of biology in some ways that are just completely and and fundamentally surprising. And let me maybe backtrack for your viewers and listeners just a little bit and give you set the basic foundation of what I mean by protein folding. And that is that the information in your genome is encoded in DNA. And that's just a long, long linear polymer of DNA that coils around and is packed into the nucleus. But that codes in the DNA codes for a protein, sort of like the way a cassette tape codes for a symphony. And the tape itself doesn't look too interesting, but some of the music that it plays is pretty amazing. And so in order for it to play that kind of music, the proteins that are first made are instructed by the code, and they come out in a linear fashion too. And then in order to function, these proteins have to fold up into very, very specific, very complicated structures and shapes. And there's thousands of different proteins in the cell, and those thousands of different proteins are doing really basically everything that makes you you, or makes a yeast cell, or a tree a tree. Their proteins are the major structural building blocks, the major reaction centers, the things that determine the inherent biological properties.
So it's the hardware.
Yeah, it's the hardware. And we quite some time ago had been working on stress responses and had discovered that one of the major things that every organism on the planet does when it gets into trouble is to try to keep its proteins folded properly. And it's just an absolute universal feature of life that when organisms are exposed to any type of stress, like a slight change in temperature or exposure to ethanol or changes in oxidation, the thing that they try hardest to protect is the proteins. And we were working on how they protect their proteins and keep everything folded. And we came across this one protein that actually could deal with disaster in a kind of amazing way. It could, when cells were exposed to extreme stresses and proteins just chaotically precipitated out of solution, this protein could actually save them by getting them, refolding them and getting back into a functional state. So we were working on this protein, and actually at the time we hadn't published it yet because a lot of people told us we were crazy, that there's no way a protein could unfold a protein aggregate. The only thing you could
How
do
many
with a protein
times
aggregate,
have I heard a scientist get rid of, say that?
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody You're told crazy. Me it was crazy.
Nothing has changed.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. So then I got a phone call from Yuri Chernov, who was working in Sue Liebman's lab, on the inheritance of a very odd factor called Psi. And I think the person who named it Psi, that's Brian Cox, named it because he was sighing a lot about how strangely it behaved. It was inherited in a way, it was a phenotype that was inherited in a way that phenotypes normally are not inherited. It just was behaving with different rules. And Yuri called me because he'd found that our protein controlled that inheritance, this protein that's involved in the folding of other proteins. And then at about that same time, Reed Wickner, working in a completely different field, postulated that some weird behavior of a trait that he was following in a different yeast cell might be due to self-perpetuating protein folds. So putting together the fact that we knew what HSP-104 did, this refolding factor did, but the fact that it was involved in the inheritance of this state made us think that maybe, indeed, the inheritance was due to this self-perpetuating protein fold. So that proved to be the case, and we did quite a bit of work on that for over about the course of about 6-7 years. And then we started to realize that, my gosh, this thing is doing some pretty interesting things. It's giving cells a whole bunch of new phenotypes, allowing them to grow in conditions they otherwise wouldn't be able to grow in. Really had some interesting biology, and we decided, let's look for some more. And that's where mm-hmm. Simon Andel came in.
Let me see if I can rehash this in very lay terms so that I can understand, and maybe my dad too. So here we have a situation where there's one protein that can control the folding state of the proteins in the cell, loosely speaking. And I guess protein folding, if you're going in environmental stress where it's 120 degrees out and you're basically cooking, your proteins are unfolding, sort of like egg white. Mm-hmm. Eggs going from clear to white, the mm-hmm. proteins are unfolding, and you want to prevent that. And there's HSP-104, this this great protein is actually preventing that from happening, doing a little bit of reversing. Is it at that point that one had some control over a protein that perpetually communicated its folding state? Maybe you could explain
let me give you a little bit more background. It formed a self-perpetuating protein aggregate, and the fact that it was a polymer, and it was very hard to start the polymer from forming. That is, that the protein had to fold in a very specific way in order to get this polymer started. But once the polymer was there, then other proteins of that same type could add on to the end, and they could just keep on adding on and adding on and adding on and adding on. And our protein...
So like Lego blocks, right? Lego blocks.
Very precise. Once you've got your base set up, then now you can add everybody else on. And this just keeps on going. And our protein, which can take apart protein aggregates, actually breaks these things in two and then allows the daughter cell to inherit. When the mother cell makes a daughter cell, then it passes some of that protein on to the daughter, and it has to have this HSP-104 activity to break the protein apart so that it can get into the daughter. And then when the daughter starts to make her own proteins, they just wind up ending up on that same polymer. And wow. So it goes on for generation after generation after generation. We've had some of these things in our laboratory for years and years now, and they've been faithfully going along, maintaining these polymers. Now, the reason the polymer is interesting is that the function of the protein when it's in the polymer is very different from its function when it's not in the polymer. So you wind up changing the biology of the cell that way. And the biology of the cell changes in a way that is inherited from generation to generation. Because
but
you inherit
not, through DNA.
not a change in nucleic acid, not a change in DNA, but a change in this folding of the protein.
So this is genetics that is not based on DNA.
That's right. It's genetics based upon, it's a protein-based inheritance.
Which is, I think that's why we thought the story was absolutely incredible and wanted to report on it.
It has some really interesting, oddly enough, it has some interesting implications with respect to evolution, but and we can get back into that in a little bit. It's kind of related to that other story I told you about with HSP90, although the mechanism is entirely different, but it does, we think, relate to evolution. But this is where Simon and Randall entered the scene, and maybe we should let them tell you a little bit about their search for their quest to try to find other proteins that did the same trick.
Great. Who started?
Oh, wow.
Well, let's do right. chronologically. Who was in the lab doing a sucker for punishment? Who was?
Yeah, I guess Simon probably first initiated the project.
So one thing that we found about these proteins, so the sub-35 protein, and then also this other one that Reid Wigner also found, the URI2 protein, was that they had a very unusual amino acid composition. And so there was an enrichment. There were certain domains, and they were enriched for glutamines, asparagines, and some other amino acids. And so we thought that might be a good idea to, a good way to find other proteins with the same similar amino acid composition. And so a mathematician in our lab at that time, Oliver King, he developed a bioinformatic algorithm. So based on this amino acid composition, and so we searched the entire, we scanned the yeast genome for domains that have a similar composition. And well, we found about 200 of these. And so then we decided to clone 100 of these, and we made a library of these domains. And then, yeah, we went and did a couple of tests. So we tested these domains for aggregation in vitro, in vivo. And we also had functional tests to test whether they are really prions. And how we started.
Were you expecting to find 200 proteins that have the ability to transmit inheritance? Must have been a finding in itself, where you're going through the genome with a computer, and the computer is telling you, oh, by the way, you know, inheritance as we know it is not only based on DNA, but look, by the fact that there's 200 of these things, holy moly,
the number was absolutely amazing. I mean, And so, yeah, I mean, this is why we also had to limit ourselves to 100. So we test only 100. And I mean, if you look at other genomes, there are many, many more of these. So this is very, it's not only in yeast, it's in many other organisms as well.
And, so Mendel flipped in his grave, right?
And only 25 of them, the 100 that we tested, only 25 actually turned out to clearly be
exactly,
trans. The others still might be, but we just
I mean,
couldn't tell.
25,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah, it was pretty astonishing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeast in a single-celled organism.
Yeah, yeah. And so Randall and Simon, Randall did an awful lot of really beautiful biochemistry on this, establishing the way in which these things form polymers, and that all you need is a little tiny seed, and once it gets started, it will polymerize and polymerize and polymerize. And Simon developed some biological assays to see that they were actually doing this in living cells, and they were a spectacular team.
Perhaps, Simon, could give us a brief overview of some of those biochemical tests so that we can understand how you went about determining whether these prion proteins, and I guess we should define prion proteins as those are the proteins that can form the polymer that can communicate information from cell to cell, from mother to daughter cell. But perhaps you tell us how you went through it. And when you thought that I had, you're sitting there, I have to do 100 of these. How did you think to do it in a way that you could do it in a timely fashion before your hair turned gray and, you know, retired?
Simon, why don't you start? Because you did the
initial thing. I can start. I mean, we used a very nice system, so the gateway system for cloning, which is recombination-based cloning. So the cloning wasn't actually a big deal. So that helped us a lot. And so then we
had
developed
a
couple
of
vectors.
Yeah, robot was a big help too.
and the robot was a big help too. So that's true. And of course, we had to set up everything high throughput. But I mean, the good thing about this is that we can now use this over and over again for other organisms too. But yeah, the thing is that we streamlined this for high throughput analysis, and so all our assays are accessible in this way. And Randall, why don't you start? I mean, and talk about the in vitro biochemistry, and then I can talk about the in vivo assays.
Sure.
That we
okay.
Did.
Yeah. So I mean, as you mentioned, Simon, you know, it sort of set out to look at 100 of these things, and clearly it was a big project. And I guess that's kind of where I came in. So we wanted to sort of divide and conquer a little bit. And the way we did that is he sort of took the cellular assays. To really, as Sue said, get at what these things are doing in vivo. And then I was asking sort of a different question, and that was, if these things are acting as prions, how much of that is due to the protein itself? So in other words, to what extent do the transacting factors like HSP104 control this process? And to answer that, I actually purified all 100 of these proteins, again, using the robot that we sort of retooled for this purpose. And then asked in a one protein system, so if we purify them and then dilute them into a physiological buffer, do they have prion properties? That is, do they polymerize in the way that we'd expect them to? And so I did that for all of them, and I came up with a list that pretty closely overlapped with what Simon was finding at the same time in cells. And that was that, I guess it was roughly 25 of them, strongly formed amyloid, and that was interesting for two reasons. One is that it really showed us that the ability to form prions was an intrinsic property, largely an intrinsic property of the sequence, and that was confusing because the sequences, as you know, as we said, were all sort of the same in terms of amino acid content. They were all glutamine and or asparagine rich. So the fact that we had such different behaviors indicated that there's a lot more to the sequence than we could have predicted, that we could have known about beforehand. And what it also tells us is that, this HSP104 protein doesn't exist in all organisms. But knowing that so much of prion behavior is in the sequence, we can then start looking in other organisms like mammalian genomes, etc., to see if we can then predict other prions that might be doing this and sort of broaden our the range of prion proteins as we know it.
Let me ask you, you guys were, you know, use the example sub 35, right? Mm-hmm. The proteins that have the propensity to form these polymers and change function from one state, functional state, to a different functional state. Is there one specific type of protein that you would want to have a trigger that could have repercussions on a downward cascade? Are those the
very
ones that have
good
the propensity?
Question, Mark.
It's a leading question, I suppose.
You'd have almost right. thought I supplied you with that question.
I probably read it in our paper. And then,
I can verify that no money was exchanged.
Sure. Because this is part of it, right? It's a huge part of the story.
Absolutely. The reason why we started really getting excited about prion biology was because of the nature of this first one we looked at, what it was doing. It's really involved in decoding the information in the cell, so it is involved in translating the nucleic acid sequence into protein, and it's involved at one particular critical step when the messenger RNA is saying, okay, stop translating now. And when this protein goes into a prion, it kind of starts to ignore some of those signals, and so you actually start making different proteins than you otherwise would. So it really is kind of right in the heart of the circuitry of what a cell is doing and making. And Simon and Randall, when they looked at this list of genes and looked at the 25 that actually were prions, had a wonderful and interesting surprise. Why don't you tell them about it, Randall?
Oh, yeah. So what we found was that those 25 proteins were strongly enriched for proteins that were controlling these other central processes, just like CEP35, proteins that were controlling the way that genetic information was read in the cell. So things like transcription factors, proteins that are controlling specifically which genes in the genome are turned on at a given time. And also things like RNA binding proteins, RNA processing proteins, things that, again, are controlling how a specific gene is giving a phenotype.
Kind of like an information gate, right? So like a decision point, a system decision point, or it's like a dip switch that can, we're getting
kind of...
And so what happens is you get a wild profusion of new phenotypes. All kinds of really new biology occurs when these things switch into a prion state.
Yep.
So it's a new sort of layer of regulation, so to speak.
Absolutely.
Right. It's a new biology.
It is, yeah. Well, we think it's a means for these organisms to survive out in the wild. They live in these really crazily fluctuating environments. The temperature goes up and down from night to day and from different seasons. And one moment they've got a lot of sugar to eat, and next moment they don't. And next moment they're in the middle of a mud puddle, and then the next minute they're splashed up on a grape leaf. And things are just happening to them all the time. Their environment is changing. And so the way they want to use their genetic information, the way they want to decode that, actually they're kind of playing a game of switching strategies every once in a while. So by having this spontaneous ability to get into this prion state, which gives them a whole different set of biological properties, they're kind of hedging their bets by the time you've got a big sized colony of a starting from a single yeast cell, you've got a big sized colony. You've actually got several other cells in there that have actually switched their bets and are doing different things. And overall, we think that will allow this organisms to survive when conditions change unexpectedly.
Let's talk about that more. I do have to thank our sponsor, and then we'll come back to the fundamental premise or promise of prions. It's both, I guess. I'd like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring Futures in Biotech. They have over 75,000 downloadable titles right now across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, periodicals. For listeners, of Futures in Biotech, Audible is offering a free audiobook download to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook that you might consider downloading for free is, I always pronounce it incorrectly, but Cro-Magnon. I pronounce it as the French, Cro-Magnon. Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans. And it's by Brian Fagan and narrated by James Langton. So in this book, he really it's a mix of cutting edge science and vivid storytelling. He sort of brings you back 35,000 years into Europe, and tells you about, based on the science, what it must have been like for early humans to live side by side with Neanderthals and the harsh environmental conditions that they had to go through. How they used and also how these early humans, you know, really took advantage of their superior intellect to beat out the Neanderthals or possibly fuse with them. Well, yeah, I don't know how it happened, but anyhow, if you want to download Cro-Magnon, How the Ice Age Gave Birth to the First Modern Humans by Brian Fagan, narrated by James Langton, head over to audible.com/biotech. You sign up for their account and you'll get a free download. If you enjoy it, you stay with the account. If you don't, you can cancel the account, but you get to keep the free book. So it's a win-win situation. So I'd like to thank audible.com for sponsoring Futures Biotech. That's audible.com/biotech for your download. So
I got a quick question.
Go for it.
Maybe it's not so quick, but I think it is. So sub-35 is a pretty interesting example in the sense that the protein prion-like conformation that it goes into is sort of sequestering it and is then basically turning off a particular activity. In the examples that you guys found, when a protein goes into a prion type of activity, is there an example where it turns on a biological function?
We think that there are, but we the one that we are clearest about is actually one that we've worked on with in collaboration with Eric Kandel and Kausik C. So Kausik was a postdoctoral fellow with Eric Kandel, and he was interested in learning and memory. And to just pause a moment here, when you think about this mechanism, it's kind of related to memory, right? Because once the cell has made this switch, it perpetuates that switch for a long, 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 long time. It sort of remembers that because it's actually encoded in the fact that the protein polymer just keeps growing and growing and growing. So Eric Kandel, who won the Nobel Prize, in fact, for his really stunningly beautiful work on learning and memory, has been step-by-step deciphering one amazing mechanism of memory after another. And his postdoc, Kausik C., noticed that one of the proteins that they were working on that's very, very important for maintaining connections between neurons in the brain had a domain on it that looked a lot like our yeast prion. It was full of these same glutamine and asparagine residues that Simon and Randall had been talking about. And it looked so much like our yeast prion protein that we thought, well, why don't we work with them? And Kausik came to my lab, but that was when I was still in Chicago. And we did set up some cloning and set up some experiments and found out that, sure enough, if we put that protein into a yeast cell, it would behave in this way. It would form these polymers, and the polymers would be passed down from mother cell to daughter cell to mother cell to daughter cell. It was so a self-perpetuating polymer. And then, George, that one is, in fact, mm-hmm. a protein which, when it's in that prion polymer state, it's far more active. And what we think happens is that it sets up a little assembly machinery for actively making proteins and translating the proteins, and that by having it polymerize, you not only make it more active, but you actually keep it local to an individual synapse in a nerve cell in the brain. So there's still a lot more work to be done on that one, but it's a pretty exciting concept, and it relates also to what Simon was talking about and Randall too, about now we're ready to go off and start look for these kinds of self-perpetuating protein states in many different organisms.
That reminds me a little bit about the, in the last episode with Futures in Biotech, we had Dr. Carla Kierkegaard, and she was explaining how poliovirus polymerized segments of the enzymes to replicate the RNA. And that having them localized improve their function.
Yes, exactly.
So let's go back to Randall. He was saying that he found 25 that in vitro formed functional not functional, but form these the polymers. How did you go
right,
about
roughly,
doing it?
Right.
Then maybe Simon can briefly explain how one looks into the cell to see that this is happening.
So how did I find that they were forming polymers in vitro?
Sure.
I
mean, yeah.
So the type of polymer that prions form is actually very specific. It's called amyloid. And amyloid is really quite a unique type of protein aggregate. It's extremely well-ordered, well-structured. And part of the consequence of that is that it's very resistant to detergents. And also that it... So that's one of the assays I used was after I allowed these proteins to incubate. So I guess I should start from the beginning. So after I purified them from bacteria, they were fully denatured. So I started with so they were all in sort of a base denatured state, so they could do sort of whatever their sequence told them to do. And then I diluted them into conditions that mimicked the conditions in a cell, essentially, and then just allowed them to sit there over time. And I followed them for 3 days, you know, just taking time points throughout the whole process. And you know, during those time points, I was actually using an amyloid-specific dye. So there's a few molecules that specifically recognize amyloid, and they fluoresce when they do this. And so by including those molecules in the reactions, I could see, just looking at fluorescence, when amyloid was forming. So that gave me the rate of assembly and told me essentially when a lot of them had done it, you know, how fast they were doing it. And then I used a second procedure to really verify that, you know, these things are actually amyloids. So it's always good to use more than one approach.
Sure.
And that was based on this detergent resistance. So basically, if I added a detergent that normally disrupts most protein structures and most types of aggregates, but doesn't disrupt amyloid, I could then see that those aggregates stayed there and that just confirming that they were, in fact, amyloid-like, or amyloid, actually. And then the final thing that I did, and I only did this for one of them that we ended up studying in more depth, was I actually took the amyloids that I had formed in vitro, these recombinant proteins that it aggregated, and transformed them directly into cells. So introducing those amyloid fibers into the cell, and then asked, do those cells now have a prion phenotype? So does that amyloid not only replicate in vitro, but when you put it in its normal cellular context, does it go on to replicate? That is it infectious? And that was true. So we actually
That's
confirmed.
The hardest criteria to meet, right? I mean, these are not just amyloid fibers like you might find in Alzheimer's. These are fibers that are infectious. So you made an infectious
right.
protein
yeah.
particle. And they did, right, and you say that your final criteria was to meet that functional infectious particle.
Yep, that's right. And that's only been done for, you know, I guess 4 or 5 proteins now. So it's really kind of the gold standard that I don't think people argue that, you know, that you're not looking at an actual prion when you can do that.
I was going to suggest going to EM, but if you can show function.
Well, I did that as well for a couple of them. So, yeah.
Like Randall said, that's the gold standard. Yeah.
Right.
Well, you can't fool an EM, right? If you see the fiber, you see the fiber, and if you can measure it, it's, you know.
That's right, right. But it was not quite as good, I guess, because, you know, sometimes amyloids are sort of buried in a mix of other types of aggregated proteins. So, for instance, one of the yeast prions actually tends not to form nice fibrillar aggregates when you look at them by EM, although they are there. There's been techniques to kind of move away the stuff that's, you know, crowding on these amyloid fibers, and you can actually sit and see the fibers. So we didn't really want to use that as sort of the fallback
sure.
approach then to confirm it.
The functional process sounds like the best way to go. And you're not trying to purify fibers. You're just trying to show, do they form fibers? And even if they form,
right, exactly.
you know, such a small fraction of them form fibers, and that changes the biological function, you say, Simon, can you test it? Right? I suppose that's a great
yeah.
part of
right, right.
teamwork.
Well, when we were doing it in parallel. So I was doing this. I mean, I started with the entire 100, right? And Simon has started with the entire 100 in his set of assays. And so that way we could really get more information. It wasn't just sort of a, you know, a funnel where we were doing one assay and then another assay on a small select set of positive candidates. But instead, in the end, we could compare across all the different assays for all the different proteins and really kind of make the best guess at which ones were most likely to be real prions with real biologically important activities. And so I mean, it turns out that there was good agreement between both of our assays.
what was the most common family of proteins that, that formed those out of those 25? Was there one predominant family of protein function?
It's not that strong of any one family. You know, we had kinases that were doing it. We had, I guess the strongest enrichment would be for transcription factors. Okay. We had several transcription factors that did it. Yeah. And then there were things like nuclear pore proteins that there was actually, that was probably the strongest enrichment of on our list altogether. I think we looked at five nuclear pore proteins and, I guess all but one of them formed amyloid pretty robustly. And we're also positive in Simon's assays. So it's not, I guess really the only commonality is, as I mentioned before, that these are proteins that control information processing. So, you know, it wasn't things. So I guess one example is that we had a number of proteins that, you know, they have Q-enriched domains and they were in our top 100 proteins to look at, but they were involved with actin polymerization. So they were doing things like, you know, allowing endocytosis to happen. And those didn't form amyloid in vitro. So again, those are things that aren't really the necessary for decoding, you know, the genome as well. So I guess that's really the only enrichment that struck me anyways.
Sure. Yeah, maybe you could ask Simon how he did the in vivo work. Sorry? We have a little bit of lag here.
I wanted to say about these. So there were also these RNA binding proteins. And so CPEB, this protein that Eric Kandel and Carl Zixi found, is also an RNA binding protein. And so we also found this enrichment in our screen. And so that I think was also very interesting. So there might be some proteins that might also have gain of function phenotype when they go into the prion state, like the CPEB protein. But we haven't really looked at this yet, but we expect this to be the case.
CPEB is a really interesting one. Eric Kandel presented at the neuroscience thing this year that I think was it overexpression of CPEB led to mice that had twice the learning capacity?
It's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. He made an intelligent mouse. He made a smarter mouse. If he can create a drug that drives CPEB formation.
Better memory.
I could use it, but no, that's a revolutionary change and it's making a superhuman twice as smart.
Yes, it is.
It's amazing. So how did you look, Simon, at the inside of the yeast to see if there was a prion formed? How do you go from, and if that communicated?
So yeah, one of the assays that I used was basically also, was looking at resistance to detergent. And so that's a very neat technique one can use. So it's basically, so what you do is you express your protein, your prion domain in a yeast cell, and then you open up this yeast cell and you make a cell lysate and you just load it on a gel. But this is a special gel, so it's like a normal agarose gel, but it also contains SDS. And so what this SDS does, it's a detergent, and it denatures all the protein complexes in a cell. But as Randall said, so amyloid is resistant to detergent. And so with this technique, we could separate the polymers from the monomeric fraction of these proteins. And so we could detect detergent-resistant amyloid with this technique, and we basically confirmed. So we found a very good overlap between what Randall found, and then in this in vivo assay where we looked for polymers in these cell lysates, and that was one of the assays that we did. And then of course we also did a functional assay, which was very important, and that was based on this translation termination factor. Sub-35, and so sub-35 has a very nice property. So when it switches to the prion state, there are cells, and in certain genetic background, these cells change their colony color. So they switch from a red colony color to a white colony color, and at the same time, they can also grow on plates that are deficient for adenine. And so we use this to look for prions. And the way we did this is we just replaced this prion domain of the sub-35 protein with a candidate prion domain, and then look whether...
Hello?
Right?
Simon? Fantastic. Great.
Got you back.
Yeah, got you back.
Okay. And so, yeah, we did this this functional assay and looking for, so we had these chimeras, these 100 chimeras, and then we also looked whether they are able to switch between a red and a white state, so whether they support this the formation of this prion state. And we found 24 that did this, and this group contained all of the prions that were known at the time, giving us a lot of confidence that we were able to find also a lot of uncharacterized prions.
So a really nifty bit of molecular biology to confirm the biochemistry that was being done. Nice job. Mm-hmm.
They were a great team.
Nice
Absolutely,
job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering a little bit about the sort of the bigger picture. You know, you've got a group of proteins here that seem to be involved in regulation. And I'm wondering how this kind of fits into the normal, I'll put quotes around normal, the normal biology of the cell. Do you guys envision this as a mechanism by which the cell can rapidly turn things off, or just another mechanism for regulation? Or do you see it stretching further into the biology of the cell?
We think it's a really quite spectacular mechanism for cells to survive fluctuating environments, and we really think it's deeply part of their biology. And some of these prions that we found have actually been conserved in yeast cells for 800 million years of evolution in fungi. It's just astonishing that this prion domain, and it's regulation by HSP-104, that whole system of protein assembly and a protein being broken up and sent into the daughter cell, that whole system has been conserved on some of these for 800 million years of evolution. And some of them are brand new. Some of them look like they've only recently arisen in yeast, and that they're providing some wonderful new properties that yeast are taking advantage of now. And what we think is happening is it's really a bet hedging strategy. So by the time these things appear spontaneously every once in a while, and they also their appearance increases when the cell is under stress. So when you think about a yeast growing, it's basically a simple colonial organism, and it starts to grow, and things are hunky-dory, and it grows some more, and pretty soon you've got about 1 million cells or 10 million cells. By the time you've got a colony of that size, you've got quite a few of them in there that have now acquired this prion state, and different cells have acquired different prions. And since each one of them confers a completely different set of biological properties, you've really got a colony of cells that's ready to go out and explore. So basically, if bad times roll in and there's no sugar available, or there's desiccation, it's too hot and dry out there, or any number of bad things happen, well, there's some individuals in that colony that have some very different biological properties and might be able to get through those hard times. And so we really think of it as a really fiendishly clever, amazing biological survival strategy.
So by altering the conformational state of the cytosol, you essentially alter the phenotype of the organism in such a way that it's relatively random in the sense that mm-hmm. you alter all sorts of different types of biological activities by altering the conformational state of a single protein.
Exactly.
What
it's astonishing, isn't it? Yeah.
How about the timeline, though? We have DNA for this, right? If we're under an extreme environmental condition, don't you have changes in the genome because there's mistakes that happen? And our basic understanding of evolution is that, well, there's enough changes and epigenetic changes in DNA that we would have an organism ready to adapt to that new environment.
Well,
or how does this
changes,
compare?
Very interesting. Epigenetic changes happen too, but what this does is what's interesting about the phenotypes that we've seen so far is that they're combinatorial. So that when this protein changes its shape, you change the translation of lots of proteins at the same time. Or when it changes, a transcription factor changes its shape to the prion state, you change the transcription of a whole bunch of genes at the same time. So you create these really quite complex phenotypes made up of multiple combinations of things that would be really quite hard to do in a single genetic change. And so, and moreover, For the most part, the cell doesn't seem to be harmed by this at all. It can sit there and it can grow and divide, and only some of the times are these traits deleterious. But it's pre-adapted. You know, there are all kinds of wonderful, beautiful biological regulatory mechanisms that will allow a cell to live in a new environment, and it takes advantage of those too. But these prions, they're already pre-adapted in sort of combinations of different strategies living in that colony. And it's only a relatively small number of the cells that do this. It looks like when things are really healthy and happy, maybe it's only one in a million cells does any one prion. Put that together, you've got maybe 25 of them, different cells in that colony at any one time. And then those cells just happen to be ready to go out and explore and do different things in a combinatorial fashion. They give you complex combinatorial phenotypes, I guess, is the answer.
I see. So can you guys think of an example where one of these prion proteins generated a cell that had some phenotypic advantage over the other cells in a population? Has anybody ever really sorted out a specific example?
I've done some work with one of our new prions that we discovered, and there are other cases as well that do similar things. But essentially, so a very easy phenotype that occurs naturally and that confers a selective advantage is the difference between cells that are free living, they don't associate with each other, and cells that stick to each other. And so one of the phenotypes that happens when cells stick to each other is that they can then invade surfaces. So they can form chains of cells that can, for instance, penetrate the surface of fruit, you know, to find new sugars and new resources. And so there's actually a number of prions now that when they switch to the prion state, the cells then stick to each other, and they actually do, at least looking at a plate, you know, we grow them on plates in the lab, but they then grow under the surface of the auger. And in the absence of the prion, they just wash off. If you just run the plate under running water, the cells all go away and, you know, they could die. But the ones that have the prion state have a clear selective advantage because they're still there. They're still on their food source. And so that's definitely something I think. I mean, it's a very easy assay to look at, and it appears to be regulated by, you know, more than one prion. So, you know, that's one example. I guess there's a few other ones that we've looked at.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. So basically in yeast, right, which is a eukaryote or a higher organism, how do you call it? How do you define it with respect to humans? We're closer to yeast than we are bacteria.
far closer.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. 70%, right? Isn't it 70% homology? Yeah. 35, 30% identity to human genome, roughly.
In our proteins, yeah.
So we're very closely related to yeast. And I guess we live intimately with yeast, and we don't live without bread and beer. But and if this is important for evolution of yeast or their adaptability, right, does this correlate to do you believe that if by scanning, you picked the yeast genome because it's extremely genetically tractable, right? But in humans, we can't knock out genes, and there's a lot of stuff we're not allowed to do. But will this carry over to vertebrates and to mammals? Is our evolution, we talked about the Cro-Magnon man, is our evolution based in part on the ability of proteins to communicate information to their offspring rather than DNA?
I think it very well might, and there's another way in which it might be used in a heritable sense that's not necessarily from generation to generation in humans, but that is that different cells and tissue types in our body differentiate, and they all have the same DNA, but they're doing very different things, and they do that very, very stably. And so one could imagine that some of these, that there are prion-like proteins that are involved in regulating those types of processes that that are part of heritable lineages within the body.
So, I see, because of the combinatorial nature of how it works.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I think these protein-based self-perpetuating states, which have they throw a switch. You go from one functional state to another functional state that's really different. But yet once you throw that switch, it self-perpetuates and goes on and on and on. I think it's just a wonderful mechanism to use in biology, and I'm betting that's going to be used all the time.
So there would be one prion for a finger and one prion for a thumb.
Well, it could be
in the middle.
Maybe quite at that level.
Sure. Okay. No, but
but you get the idea that you could have certain types of cellular lineages, and in fact, some of the proteins that are known to be involved in regulating what they call cell fate determinants have some of these pretty unlooking like domains on them. So we've got a lot more work to do to get a real sense of how broad this is, but I'm betting that it's going to be very broad. I think Simon and Randall are too.
I think it's going to require a huge team to really put your finger on how important prions are. You know, we all thought prions were just about disease. I mean, that's right. How the general public thinks. It's, you know, this mad cow is a protein that gets transmitted when you eat cow beef that it's contaminated, and it's simply a disease. But it seems to have an overwhelming, just this work proved that a yeast's ability to adapt in nature is based on the formation or the inheritance, right, of information from a protein, not from DNA. That's what's this is changing evolution or understanding of evolution. Yep. It's adding a major component.
Right. And we need to be out there in the real living environment too, and see how they're functioning out there. And that's something that Randall's continuing to work on right now in my lab. And excellent. What Simon's going to be doing is looking, switching to different organisms and looking for them and some other very interesting organisms in completely different evolutionary contexts. So there's we're all fired up about it. And we can't wait to keep going.
We're going to still work on getting Dr. Kendall on again. He's been on the show. And I'd like to, maybe Dr. Lindquist could help co-host this episode because of her expertise in the area. Because his work, that the CPEB protein that is in neurons, and when it changes state, enables long-term memory potentiation and makes mice smarter. I mean, that's a major, major discovery. When I was listening to his talk at Neuroscience, there was 10,000 people in the room. And here he is in his... Is he in his early 80s? He's 79.
He just went to his 80th birthday party a couple of months ago.
And here he is giving a talk, like a 25-year-old on fire for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
60 or 70 slides. And we're all thinking, he's going after a second Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
If it's possible.
He's amazing. He's just a wonderful person, too.
But before we go, I'd like to ask you, basically, I'm trying to understand how you... you formulate your scientific thoughts. It looks, from what I've been following your work, it seems that you're going after getting an understanding of how protein folding affects biology, but your focus seems to be primarily on evolution. And I mean, it's an enormous amount of work to try and define how protein folding modulates evolution.
Go ahead.
You're doing it. How are you formulating your ideas to your follow your track?
I think the most interesting thing is when you get a surprising result. I mean, it's very. I remember when I was younger, and I would set up an experiment, and I was hoping to get such and such a result, and I would not get that result, and I'd be terribly disappointed. And then I finally somehow or other learned that, oh my gosh, well, if you've done the experiment really well and it's very well controlled, and you're not getting the answer you expected, it's probably telling you something you didn't know or didn't guess at. And that's actually, in my lifetime at least, turned out to be the things that have always been the most interesting and fun and surprising things to follow. And so we're following it, at the trail of where this protein folding stuff takes us, wherever it happens to take us. Actually, I would say if I had any one strategy, it's kind of constantly to be looking for surprises. And it's taken us in two different areas of evolution, but we actually are also looking in neurodegenerative diseases and cancers, because these are two of mankind's greatest scourges, and it turns out that they are very, very dependent upon changes in protein folding. So we're doing some of that too.
In 2006,
depends upon doing all this stuff. Depends upon having people like Simon and Randall. Are just, you know, they're a dream to work with. They're just really so smart and so able and have a lot of their own ideas and bring a lot to the table. And that's the reason I can do what I do.
the teamwork is essential. Let me ask you, in 2006, we talked about how HSP90, by modulating the levels of active HSP90, it's a chaperone protein for the audience. It's a protein that helps other proteins fold. And it seemed to be selective for important signaling molecules in the cell, which define the outcome of that mm-hmm. cell's nature. So you've had some recent successes studying HSP90. Is there anything that you'd like to report here? Is there?
We've got some great new stuff on HSP90 and yeast. Another wonderful postdoc, Dan Jaroche, has managed to actually finally map the genetic variation that's being controlled by HSP90 in a global genome-wide way. He's got 400 different traits that he's mapped. It's amazing. So we've in fact just submitted that paper for publication, and one of these days we can talk about that one, I hope.
Well, it's kind of the key of evolution here. Here's what we were talking about back then is the capacitor. It's the one protein that if you suppress it because of an environmental stress, you could basically suppress evolution or modulate the rate of evolution, which is kind of
It's really kind of amazing. Great story. Yeah.
So we'll have to have you back to when the paper gets published.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
That will be a part two to the part one. Now, this one is a different tangent.
Continuing saga.
Great. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Dr. Lindquist.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Great questions.
That was Dr. Susan Lindquist, professor of biology at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. We also had Dr. Simon Alberti from Max Planck. Institute in Dresden. Thank you very much for coming on, Simon.
It's been great.
Congratulations on the work. It was really pretty amazing and
outstanding.
Yeah, we enjoyed reading the paper and discussing it in our office here for hours on end.
It was a very heated conversation. No, I'm just joking.
Right. Yeah, some proteins got unfolded, right? and thank you, Randall Hoffman, who was a graduate student in Dr. Susan Lindquist's lab at MIT. Thank you very much for coming on. Congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me. Thanks again.
No problem. I'd like to also thank my co-host here, Dr. George Farr, who's vice president of biochemistry and biophysics at Aromics. Something like that. And thank you for coming on.
Pleasure.
I'd also like to thank John Slonina, who was our producer today and took care of the recording and the boards. Thank you, John. I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible: Leo Laporte, Dean Golden, Colleen Kelly, Eric Lanigan, Tony Wang, Frederick Louis, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. If you need transcripts done, we're working on them. Visit futuresinbiotech.com. They are provided by the kind of folks at Pods in Print. If you need transcripts done, you can handle it. And lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier and Will Hall for the opening and closing themes. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.